Yes, we're good. All right.
Hello and welcome back to Projecting. Scott is here with me, and we're in my parents' kitchen at their house.
Beautiful space.
Yep. We had I discovered a really stupid rule with USB microphones. If you have the same kind, Apple kind of like, well, I don't even know if it's just Apple, but GarageBand like doesn't allow you to use two of the same mic at the same time. It like crosses signals and gets all confused. So I'm going to have to come up with a workaround for that, probably record on two different devices. So Scott and I are just doing bi-directional right now, and hopefully it sounds good enough for all of you, but screw you, you don't pay me. So Scott, welcome back. We did the two-parter last time you were in town. Well, not the last time you were in town, but I think it was, what, in the summer?
Yeah, during the summer.
And we did the thing on Creole identity, and since you've gone to Sciences Po up in France and up in Paris, you're living near the Arc de Triomphe. Not exactly slumming as far as locations go.
No, definitely not.
And you've had very, I'm saying too much, you've had a very interesting first semester. You've dealt with the amazing bureaucracy and incredible efficiency that marks the French government. you've obviously the ISIS attacks happened. You've first semester of your master's program completed after an intense workload and just drain on your soul. And I think that bounced the super Cliff Notes version. So yeah, tell us a little bit about moving to Paris. Obviously you're no stranger to France, being pretty fluent, relatively fluent in it, even before you got there and having traveled there before multiple times.
No, I moved there, at the end of the summer. And that was, the transition over there is about as easy as it gets. One of my best friends from undergrad, Antoine, ended up messaging me. And he was like, oh, do you still need a place to stay in Paris? I was like, yeah, I need a place to stay. And he goes, that's great. My twin brother has a place. And I go, Antoine, you have a twin brother? And so we ended up...
How long have you known him?
Yeah, I've known Antoine for 3 years of undergrad. So lo and behold, the magical twin brother appears that I had none. I messaged all my friends at the time. I was like, does anyone know that Antoine has a twin brother? And everyone's like, oh, no, I don't think we did. So, but no...
Making sure you weren't just being an asshole.
Yeah. Lo and behold, I ended up landing this apartment that's in a... very beautiful area in the 16th, close to the Arc de Triomphe. And so I was very fortunate when I was coming in because I did not have to do the frantic apartment hunting, which I think makes people jaded before they even, get feet on the ground. But, it's been a whirlwind this semester. I think Paris is an interesting city to be living in right now, but not interesting for all the, reasons that it should be interesting, in the sense that it's a absolutely gorgeous city. And I think it's one of those few places on earth where it's as much a lifestyle as it is a place. And so,
In what ways?
Well, I think it's almost an idea behind it. It's, it's beyond just stereotyping the culture, but you sit down on a cafe and you sit there for an hour and you drink your demi-tasse, which only takes you 30 seconds to drink if you're actually wanting to drink it, but you sip at it and you stay there. And I think that there's sort of this, the culture is by no stretch, it's not like, at ease and kind of calm. I wouldn't mark, Parisian life in that way. But there are these keen moments where you're able to sit there and kind of get insight, and you're with someone and you don't check your phone. You just sit there and you're with them and you stay and you have a nice meal for 2 hours. And I think we get insights into that in New Orleans, at all times. It's part of our lifestyle as well. Maybe one of the crossovers between the two cultures, but it's something that I think is, right when you get there off the bat, it's something that you can appreciate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you started actually your classes this semester as well. Tell us a little bit about Sciences Po and kind of like the getting into the groove of transitioning from a American university to a French one. I mean, obviously there's huge gaps just from undergrad to graduate school. I mean, that alone is going to be radically different, but what about just on a more basic...
One of the jokes I was telling one of my friends when we first got there, going to, Sciences Po is sort of like, it's a mystery wrapped in an enigma, and I love it. It's one of those things that sort of, when you're going into that process, it's sort of a take no prisoners type of system. You go in and every single person signs up for courses at the same time. So here you are sitting there at, 5 a.m. in the morning in the United States, signing up for your registration and taking your course, or you have to do it and you kind of just sort of go with it and hope it all works out. And it normally does. I think that's one of the things, is that you have to adjust, and it really is, you know, it's a great moment in terms of maturing into an adult, because you have to sit there and you go, literally no one is going to tell you how to do it. So these moments where you have to sit there, figure it out, talk with whomever you need to talk to, and get the information beforehand, and then you go into the registration process, and it's you and 1,000 of your best friends frantically trying to click to get the course at the right time. And that's just very different from sort of
that was your experience this morning, right? You were saying signing
for classes. This morning as well.
So yeah, tell a little bit about just signing up for courses this morning. I mean, you were saying they let it all at once, right? Everyone in the entire school
starts at the exact same time. Almost at the exact same time. And, you know, at least in our program at Paris School of International Affairs, we get, you know, 14, I think it's like 1,100 of us or whatever. And so everyone has to go in at the same time and choose these courses. And, you know, it's unbelievably limited. And you have Saturday courses that no one wants to touch with a 1,000-foot pole. And so, you know, it further limits the course selection. And they ended up not having enough spots for one of the mandatory courses we all had to take. So that added a level of complexity to it all. So it's just normally there many a time where you're at these situations, you feel like your back is up against the wall, but you never get totally thrown out. You know, you eventually figure out a solution. You're like, well, that was painful, required sitting in a 3-hour line, but it's solved.
Probably unnecessary.
Yeah, well, the bureaucracy is expanding to meet the needs of the expanding bureaucracy.
Right.
Or so it feels.
Who said that? What was that from? Okay. Let me make one quick adjustment. Make sure you're getting the cleanest audio here possible. Great.
Okay.
All gravy. Yeah, good. Okay. So, as we were saying, so you did your first semester, and so how many courses were you taking? Like, what was kind of like your workload like?
Oof, we had to take 8 courses, so 8 grad level courses, and one of them is sort of an expanded course. That's the Formation Commune, so it's sort of weighted differently. But yeah, it was sort of I gotta admit, that was one of the things I'm not sure. You know, you process it on the front, and you're like, oh, you know, that's interesting. I might have to take 8 courses, and then you have to take 8 courses, and you're sitting in class, and you're, you know, and then 8. And the weird thing, it's not weird. It makes sense to a certain degree, but it's just so different. The model is that they end up having midterms, which are like 50% of your grade, and then they end up having finals, which are 50% of your grade, and that makes things simple. But I'm used to the American system where, you know, you have an essay and participation and this, that, and the other. So the problem is, you know, things are kind of coasting along for a little while, and then you get to midterm period and everyone's frantic, and then you get to the finals period and it's just like you're going through the midterm period again. So it kind of just structured differently in that regard.
Yeah. Obviously, the big disruption, the hot topic everyone was discussing for a while was, you know, the Paris attacks. I mean, that was, I remember you calling me, and I was, maybe you'll mind me switching gears here.
Sure.
I remember you were like in the middle, you were approaching midterms at that point, weren't you?
We were after.
It was right after midterms? Okay.
We had a lot of projects due during that period, but yeah.
No. And then just all of a sudden that happened. I remember I was at a wedding and you called me up, I was like walking into the reception of a wedding, and all of a sudden you called up, and I was like, wait, what? And suddenly, and Marshall and I were furiously Googling, and we're just like, wait,
what's going on? Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, very glad to hear you were safe.
Yeah.
But yeah, talk a little bit about that if you're cool with it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was interesting. One of my friends from Sciences Po ended up calling me right when everything started to happen. And this was, I think, no one knew about the Bataclan at that moment. As common knowledge, but we knew about
the attacks. That's what Eagles of Death Metal playing, right?
Yeah.
With the band.
Yeah. But we knew about the attacks on the cafes, and one of my friends called me while I was just about to go for a run. I was just leaving, and he called me and he goes, you know, are you safe? And I could hear all the police sirens in the background. It's because they were at the Canal Saint-Martin one block off, you know? And so he ended up giving me a call, and it's like, I'm sorry, I got to go. So then I kind of was like, well, I'm going to go back inside, because just where I live in Paris is very close to, and where I go for runs all the time is by, you go by Trocadero, where the Eiffel Tower is, and then you go by Place d'Etoile, where the Arc de Triomphe is, and these are two very obvious locations for something like this to happen, and no one knew what was going on, so I was just like, I'm going to go straight back home. And I think you know, that it was sort of it was almost this Orwellian feel. It was just, the weekend was very, we were all told to stay inside and everyone, was all under lockdown. And one of my very good friends, because this happened fairly late and he had fallen asleep the night before and he woke up the next morning and didn't know. So he woke up to this information, which is right. As everyone was trying to frantically get in touch with each other and, figure out what was going on. So I remember that being particularly, distressing, getting the, talking to him in the morning and being like, he's like, what the hell, what happened? And you kind of have to talk and explain it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so talk a little bit about watching it though there and seeing the media coverage and the political reaction, even just people on the street. I mean, obviously you have a very different view. Not even just from a French view, but as an American in France when this went down.
Yeah, I think that's always something that's important, is recognizing that, I am a happy, I'm happy to live there and willing to be there and, enjoy being in Paris, but I am not French, Right. So I think that when you go through, when something like this happens, I think that you need to take precautions to keep yourself safe and be, understand what's going on around you. But I also think you have to have a sort of an appreciation for that this is their country and this is under attack. And, no matter how much you feel under siege, it's worse in the sense of when it's your home.
At the end of the day, you get on a plane, you go back to the U.S.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, and I'm an invested stakeholder in France. I love being there and I love their culture.
Not to cheapen your love and relationship with them. But you ultimately know that. If no matter how bad it gets, you're not stuck there. It's not your final home.
Yeah. And I think, one of the things that was immediate was, as I was mentioning earlier, as Paris is as much a lifestyle as it is a place, and indeed France, the culture, I think that was what was so poignant about the attacks, is that it was an attack on a cult, on a lifestyle. In particular, it's an attack on the youth of that lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And I think that was what was very disconcerting right off the beat, because it was, that sense was there of what was being lost, and people were changing the lifestyle. And I understand the impulse to do so. But you could walk.
You say people change the lifestyle. You're saying,
They're not going to go to cafes. They're not going to go to cafes.
You're not the average person.
Yeah. Just
impacted their consumption within, where they go.
Yeah, the day after, the cafes are closed. But even, after that, people are not going to be in the cafes. They're going to look around left and right and, figure out what's going on. And that is something that just comes with the pervasiveness of fear immediately after these things. But I think that, it probably will change some of the lifestyle.
Yeah.
But I also think that, the French were very, at least the commentary was very defiant and very... keen on saying that we understand that this will adopt our lifestyle for a while, but our lifestyle will not change permanently. Right. You cannot, they had this one woman, I remember talking on the news, and she was like, we are a proud and ancient people, and we will persevere through this,
Right.
And to be honest with you, when you stretch out the history, I mean, as troubling and as, much we need to address these issues as they stand today, when you have a little bit of historical perspective, it's sort of the best of times and the worst of times.
Right.
So I think that's sort of what they're, as a culture, I think the mentality and the way people are talking definitely instills that idea, which is important.
And if you feel comfortable, how do you feel about Hollande and the government's reaction and kind of like their steps? I know they're obviously between a rock and a hard place. France has never been particularly quiet about their distaste for U.S. actions in the Middle East and kind of the stuff, but in a lot of cases, rightfully so.
After these types of events, these are when you hold your values closest, and this is why we have our values. So in the case of France, not just a cliche tagline, but it's real: liberté, égalité, fraternité. These are the three ideas that form the republic, and I think that these are the it's not, I think that they don't, they should not serve an ancillary role to what you're, when you're under attack. They should not be sort of the ideas that you hold up in theory. It should be, these are literally what we're holding on to right now as our vanguard against these attacks.
Well, Ben Gilliatt and I talked a lot about that once. We were saying, it was, in a game we talked too much about, and the guy says, now is exactly the time for ideals. And it's like, the ideals inform your action. You don't make actions in spite of your ideals. Mm-hmm. You don't defy them with your actions. Instead, you use them to inform them.
Yeah. You know, and I there's a very rigorous debate going on in France right now, and I think that it'll be they're going to be dealing with a lot of the same questions that the United States has had to deal mm-hmm. with at different times, and I think that's important because I think that, to be honest with you, that is a commonality between our cultures in the face of these issues. You know, that's sort of the idea is like en face du terrorisme, courage. You know, in the face of terrorism, you must have courage, and I think that it takes, and that's not just individual; that's political.
Or even on the battlefield. It's not even just about, you know, you stand against the evil. It's about how you move forward as a nation, as a political entity, as the experiment that is democracy in a lot of ways. It's very, you know.
And I remember after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, I thought it was really interesting. I just was watching the French news, and Emmanuel Vos had a really interesting line because it was, what we forget about the Charlie Hebdo attacks is there was also the attack on I think it was a Jewish grocery store.
Right.
You know, and that was just, you know, a blatant anti-Semitic attack, and that was committed by the same perpetrators. But I think that one of the things that was Emmanuel Vos came out, and regardless of your politics, that he just said, if the Jewish population leaves France, then the French Republic has failed.
Right.
And I thought that was a very poignant idea because I think that in that moment, just as people were rallying behind free speech, behind the, you know, after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, this was sort of the idea of, you know, égalité, fraternité, and it's particularly the fraternity part of it, sitting there and going, we are all French. We are all citizens in the Republic. And I thought, right now, I think that that impulse is going to be maybe redirected, and they're going to have to think about, you know, these are the three values that underpin us. You know, we are, you know, this is scary. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's, I'm sure they will be proactive. At least the debate is there. And I think that the commentary that I've heard on the by-and-by has been very, you know, it's been productive. You know, mm-hmm. they had the regional elections after the attacks, and everyone's thinking, well, now the Front National is about, you know, going to go take all the regions.
Right.
But reality is, you know, the French, they kind of moderated it. The rhetoric, I think, held through, and the Front National actually just had a huge electoral defeat after something that's as traumatic as those events that one would think would push people.
The moment for them to capitalize to reactionary and jump politics. In, right.
I thought that was very interesting. I thought that was a moment where, you know, regardless of whether someone's a Front National supporter or not, I just thought that the fact that the politics, you know, was able to moderate and also people were able to think through in the face of these things was very, very impressive. As someone who's interested in politics and is studying politics in France, I thought it was, you know, a very subtle act in many ways because, you know, a year from now, we're probably not going to remember the regional elections. But I think that...
But if they had won, it would have...
No, but then we would have remembered the regional election.
I was going to say, it would have been a different direction.
Yeah, and perhaps that's the thing, is sometimes, you know, what doesn't make the tagline is also important.
Yeah.
So, I thought that was really interesting.
I mean, beyond interesting, honestly. I mean, it, like you said, it's the time. I mean, in a lot of ways, and this is as an outsider, someone who's not, it does not know as much about French politics as you do, and someone who's learned a lot from listening to you and then going and reading things and trying to learn a little bit about what you're experiencing. And the Front National winning, in my opinion, would have been an abandonment of ideals in a lot of ways because that group is not like totally antithetical. They're not like the Nazi party, but I mean, it's like, you know, but in a lot of ways, they're kind of a terrifying organization. It's there's a lot of boot thumping, a lot of saber rattling, and then sometimes straight up just racist things that come out of groups like that. And you saw it in Italy, saw it and it's a kind of a wave that's happening in Western Europe right now, where you're seeing these groups like Donald Trump and these conservative populist movements. Right? Yeah. I mean, it's in a lot of ways. I didn't really know. I followed the Front National elections a little bit just because you, but you obviously, like I said, have more knowledge. And I think hearing that they suffered more defeats was like, all right, good. That shows maybe France is learned a little bit from the US's mistakes.
Well, even beyond our mistakes, you know, it's their own politics. It's, right. You know, at the end of the day, you know, when people are voting, I'm not sure they have an eye towards the US necessarily in that moment, you know, and I think that what's going on is just the politics on the ground and the discourse that they have fostered over the centuries, you know, served its purpose, you know? And I think that's something that's important. And that's what you do. You know, you keep your ideals close and, you know, they'll have to, I don't know all the directions these things will take. I mean, there are things that are troubling and there are things that are good and, you know, but it was just really interesting to see those events as they unfolded.
And how have you found the American versus French press coverage of these events?
Oh, it is so different.
I know we talked.
To be honest with you, I thought the American, like the U.S. rhetoric, at least you know, just the commentators that you get sometimes, that it was just so much more bellicose.
Define across multiple outlets. You mean just like across the board? It was like that.
Yeah, and it's inflammatory speech at times, where I think. It's not just to put the French media on a pedestal, because I mean their problems too beyond anything, but you know, but the French, you know, for example, there's a program that I really like. There's Cid en l'air, but there's also 28 minutes on Arte TV, and it's just they sit down. I think it's like it might be 28 minutes, but they sit down and they just, you know, they had a very interesting discussion after all that's been going on, and you know, and it's not necessarily objective. I think that we counterposition opinionated press with objectivity, as if objectivity is always going to be, you know, trustworthy and opinionated,
or even obtainable.
I mean, or attainable.
Just, yeah, it's the obsession with I want unbiased media, yeah, which is kind of a fruitless goal. Yeah,
but it's you know, to be honest, I'm sure Sarah, that what they're saying.
I know Sarah's groaning, yeah, if she's hearing me right now. Whenever we talk, I always end up somehow bringing the conversation to media bias. Drives her crazy. Sorry.
But one of the things, though, is that whether or not they're on the left or they're on the right, it's just so well thought out. You know, they're sitting there and they're having legitimate debates about Islam, and what does Islam mean, and what should we interpret this as being, and what is the role of Islam within French society? And this is the day, these are like the days after everything that's going on, and this is a debate that should be had to a certain degree. You know, you should be talking about these things, and what are the
found there's a better mustering of facts and rhetoric as opposed, yeah, to American debates.
And also assuming that you know, you know, what Islam is. Yeah, like you understand that, like, it's just a baseline knowledge that you know.
Right.
You know, and I just think it produces a discourse that, you know, regardless of whether you're on the left or the right, or your particular commentators on the left or the right, because you have a socialist or a communist talking at the same time that someone from who's a Gaullist is sitting up there having the same conversation, but both sides are just so.
Is it Gaullist? Well,
De Gaulle.
Yeah, is that reference to De Gaulle? Okay, yeah. I'm just not familiar with it.
Yeah, it's kind of a little bit further to the right. In terms of their politics,
kind of like their neocons for us, or not?
No, it's its own politics. It's its own kind of, you know.
Gotcha.
But it's just, anyway, further, it's just further to the right. Gotcha. Yeah. But it's such an interesting discourse to have. Whereas, you know, you turn on the, you know, US TV, and I remember watching a little bit of it because you can lie. I have CNN, oddly. I was just watching, and you're sitting there going, like, you know, this discourse is just it's almost. It's unintelligible because it just doesn't even assume the facts. You know, it's one thing to be biased on the left or the right, but it, you know, it's when you just abandon fact and then everything becomes truly opinion, you know?
Well, everything gets thrown under this banner of terrorist. And then the most specific you ever get out of it now is moderate, radical. It's like moderate Islam and radical Islam, right? And that's about as specific as it gets. And suddenly they've divided everything into these two very vague, pretty much inaccurate umbrellas. So whenever, like, the France debate, all it was just like Islamic radicals, Islam is radical. It's like, well, yes, but like we need to discuss. Like, there wasn't a whole lot of conversation. Yeah. Like, I saw a number of people going, I can't believe this happened in France. How'd it happen in France? Like, well, France is one of the largest, has like the largest Muslim population in Western Europe, isn't that right?
Yeah, they're about
to. Yeah, I mean, it's like this was actually a powder keg that was not. This didn't just happen out of nowhere. France wasn't picked at random, and I think that, you know, not that France like deserved it or did something to earn it. It's just strictly a like. Well, I'm surprised people were saying that on internationally broadcast television. It's like, guys, like you're clearly demonstrating you don't understand at all what was going on the ground in France before this. Yeah. You know, it just baffles me. And so that's what you're saying, right? You're just like, they come in, there's a much more informed, understood, even if it's just the basic premise they're working from, sounds like they're a little more established, and there's a little more, there's some numbers and some stats.
It's I always remember.
It's not almost just pure vague eccentricities.
I mean, I do remember it was Le Monde or Le Figaro or someone I was reading the day after or a few days after. You know, they were talking about, you know, if France was going to go into Syria and all that stuff. And they had an unbelievably detailed map of like, well, this is where the Alawites live and this is where this group is and all of this stuff. And they were going through it. And then the night show started talking about this. Like, well, as we all know, you know, the Alawites live here. And yeah, and it was, you know, it's not that it needs to be that highbrow. You know, it doesn't need to be that kind of like everyone in the world needs to know all the demarcated borders within a country.
But it treats its audience like they're informed.
Yeah, and I think that that was important though, because if you're going to have a debate on Syria, then you should probably talk about the Alawites. If you're going to, you know, and I think that's what the thing is. It's when you're listening to some of the discourse in the United States after it, what was surprising is you're sitting there going, you know, you're putting these into these almost cosmological terms of good versus evil, which, yeah, no, listen, like what happens is evil, like this is true. You know, we can morally apply this title to what has happened. But when you start turning these into these large cosmology, you know,
when you're turning it into how to make policy and how to react to a situation, you got to kind of, all right, let's get
then
down
to
the
specifics. Then you need to nuance.
Yeah,
then you need to nuance.
The specifics of it.
And I think that's what's...
It's not evil guys here, bomb evil, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I
which
think
is that, what we, I think a lot of Americans really believe it's that simple. Like the Islamic State is this one base of people. It's like, it's not that simple. Yeah, it's so much more complicated.
You need to understand what the, you know, who's funding whom and, you know, like... And it was a very but going through those events and being able to sit there, as I said, you know, as someone who's going through this in Paris, but understanding that I'm not a French citizen, but still invested within the community, but also
you
as,
care about it.
You're, absolutely. You know, and
in a very deep way, you've always like you've always felt a very strong connection in France. And
well, and I thought that was something that was very interesting too. Is, you know, the joke in Europe is, and this is about finances, but it's about, you know, when the United States catches a cold, you know, well, when the United States sneezes, Europe catches a cold, and it's just, you know, the contagion effect between it. But I thought what was so interesting about it is, yeah, you know, when France was hit like that, the world stopped for a moment, and I thought that was really telling. I mean, I thought there was a lot of goodwill, you know, poured out in favor of the country. And I think that's something that was very appreciated on the ground in France. You know, I think that's
well, it's easy for us to make fun of them, be cynical. We all, like, all the countries give each other hell and, you know, blame this or that. But, you know, when America extended a hand, despite all the mistakes we've made in the past decade, France was happy to have its long, you know, a relatively long in the grand scheme of things ally step in, you know.
Well, they are
and
sister
offer.
Republics in their own
right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Different like, ideas of where, you know, different senses of.
But it's good to know those relationships still run deep. Like, at the end of the day, like, I always view it as like France, England, America kind of got each other's backs. You know what I mean? It's like, despite, you know what I'm saying? It sounds, I know it's such a like classic, like white Western idea, but like it is very much when that happened in France, we all really did care without even to think about it. It's not like we had to consider, oh, where did that? It's like, wait, France was attacked. Whoa, like stop the press. You know, there was kind of an emotional reaction to it. There was a very emotional reaction to it.
And it's and I think as a, you know, and not to harp on it too much, but as I said, it's like, if you strike France, you're attacking an idea. You're attacking, you know, a lifestyle. You're attacking, you know, a beautiful culture. But
they didn't care about the building. They cared about what represented the people within it.
Exactly. And I think that was what was so poignant about it. I remember going for a run right after, you know, a day or two after, and I thought it was so interesting. It was, well, you know, symbolism. I don't know, just like the little things that people do that, you know, make a symbolic gesture. And I don't know if they had done it previously, but they lit up the Eiffel Tower to the tricolore.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to the tricolore. And I just think at that moment, France was just sort of like, you know, there's just sort of this moment of like, you know, everything's in suspense. But then you have this, you know, yeah, obviously the Eiffel Tower is the Eiffel Tower. And then you light it up to be the tricolore. And I think it was just a symbol of sort of tomorrow will come, you know,
well,
the day will come after.
We're still here.
Yeah.
You know, we're proud. Like, we are still the red, white, blue of France. And it's true. It was beautiful. I mean, you remember you sent a picture to us. I was like, that's beautiful. I mean, it's exactly the same, in my opinion, as when they had the two huge spotlights in the World Trade Center's marked.
Yeah,
that's exactly what it was. And to people, it was just like, it's, you know, we're still here. Yeah. The memory's here. Never forget. Blah, you know, all that rhetoric. And like, I think that's what those two, I mean, those spotlights stood there for a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I think it's a lot of similarities.
You got to think about the psychological impact. You know, it's a very emotional time for people.
Yep.
And it's like with Katrina or any other disaster that happens, obviously that was natural, but I just think it's gonna take years for people to really even somewhat understand what happened to them personally.
Yeah.
Like you're saying, like, I wouldn't be, you know, probably take decades for people to suddenly turn around and go, we treat cafes completely differently now. Like, and hopefully they don't, you know, it's always going to be, you know, it's hard to know what the full ripple effect's going to be. It's so deep and so subtle.
Yeah.
But you hope that's, doesn't fundamentally alter the people who are affected.
Mm-hmm.
Little weight there, huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, and then, I mean, I'm just glad you're safe. I'm just glad it all turned out okay with you, man. It was just, that was obviously a very scary time for us all.
Yeah. Well, and it was, as we were mentioning, it's been an unbelievably informative semester in terms of even the course. Yeah, you know, just like to be able to talk about it in class after, and, you know, I missed all my fine, you know, all this econ stuff, you know, you finally kind of bring it back down to earth and you're like, you know, well, what's going on here?
Yeah.
So, so interesting.
Well, if there's one thing we know will survive the attacks in Paris, it's French's roundabout bureaucracy. It's indestructible. It's a monolith. It's a force of nature.
It works 80% of the time, but when it fails with a profound sense of glory.
Well, Anne Marshall always tells her story of trying to get the internet set up when she first got there. She was just like, oh my God.
It's like my getting my cell phone.
She said she knew she had made it in France when it took her an eternity to get set up. It took her like 20 minutes to get it taken down and she was done. She was just like, she's went, she told them what she wanted, and they just start, she's like, this just was like forcing it down their throats. Yeah, just like forces it down their throats, acts French, and just like, turn off my internet, like, done. And she was just like, ha, I'm French now.
I was like, when I had to get my Metro card.
Oh, yeah, please, I know, I'd love to switch gears here. I remember you told me the story before, it's so damn funny. For those of you who don't know, you got to get a Metro card in France, but this story, I really feel like encapsulates kind of why we roll our eyes at the French sometimes.
No.
Oh, I mean in a loving way. You know what I'm saying? Like, you just, when you think of these stereotypes, like Americans do this and French, this is like such a, like, of course this happened to you story.
Well, I gotta admit, even with, like, you know, you realize the frustration, to be honest, if you don't speak French and you have to walk into these situations, how, like, there's not enough hand gestures in the world. But I had to get a Metro card, and, you know, you got to get, you know, the official ID from the official photo booth, from the official Metro station, from the official, you know, road. Yeah, that's on certain road. But what ended up happening is I go to the photomaton booth, which is just where you get, like, your picture taken. And I walk in with a 10 euro bill. And I walk in there, and it only takes 5s and 20s. I'm like, what? Like, the thing takes the bill. It's going to take the bill. Why are you only taking 5 and 20? So then I walk over, go out, go to the Franc Prix, you know, and ask the gentleman if he can break a 10. Yeah, I break a whatever it
a
was.
A 10 euro, yeah.
Yeah, 10 euro and give me 2 5s. And the guy goes, no. Excuse me?
This is all in French, right?
Yeah. He's like, no, I can't give it to you. I was like, why? And he goes, well, you know, I don't have it in this machine. And there are like 5 different cash registers. And I'm like, well, what about those? He goes, oh, someone's in line. There was a person buying a baguette behind me. Just a baguette that you pay 1 euro for. And I was like, I'll wait. And he goes, you might have to wait a while. And I was like, do you mean I have to wait a while? And he goes, well, I'll have to get my manager. And I'm like, like, do you not have access to the cash register? And then finally, we get the manager. They open the thing up. And then he says, well, you know, I don't know. Can you go to another place? And then I start having someone next to me translating to me in, from French to English saying, well, they don't have a $5, you know, 5 euro bill. I was like, no, I speak French. I get it. Like, I know what's going on. And they're like, oh, but clearly you don't. I was like, no, I really do. I just need them to open the cash register so I can get the 5 euro so I can go back to the broken photomaton booth to get my stuff. And it ended up being this whole rigmarole. And finally, one of the other cashiers come in and they like are going to ring up someone else. And I just, you know, and I ask the woman for like a 5 euro bill and she goes, oh, sure. And just gives it to me. And so it's like 10, 15 minute thing where everyone's back in the, you know, behind closed doors negotiating how to get me this 5 euro bill. And just this woman walks up and gives it to me straight out. So then I go back, get my photo, you know, and then end up finally getting my little Navigo pass.
Actually, you just walk by whistling a good old patriot tune.
These are the types of moments where, you know, it will always resolve itself. And that's the most interesting thing over there. I think there are situations in life where, like, you run up into a bureaucracy and you're like, well, this is going to enter the void. But there is always this way of like walking in and, you know, like you will eventually get it done. You know, it might be a painful 3-hour long process. you know, lines on lines on lines, but it will be done.
So that's interesting. You used Into the Void, actually a very famous French movie.
Oh, but, well, there you go.
Yeah, really, really art house and weird, but very good.
Oh, there you go.
Heavy. Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, it'll sort itself out, but it's hurting cats until then.
Yeah.
Oh man. Well, you have anything else? I mean, this is a little on the shorter side. We could, you know, there are other things we can go into. We've got another 15 minutes if you want it.
Sure. Well, I know you want to do, you're interested in the credit swap stuff I was learning.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have a ton of time, but I'd love to kind of get into that because that was one of the subjects as you went into it. I was kind of like, oh God, I'm not going to be able to process this. And then, like, you actually are pretty decent at explaining it. Economics is one of those things that either clicks or it doesn't for people. And yeah. I'm definitely in the, like, I will get it eventually, but I need it. I need to understand all the terms that are going on. And I found that it was really interesting. So Scott and I were talking a bit about, I brought up The Big Short and brought up about, you know, that movie's about the housing crisis. And Scott got into really interesting, we don't have to go necessarily into the Europe one, but I thought just the 9/11 example was fascinating.
Yeah.
Cause I had no idea this had happened. So this kind of a really big switch gears. Y'all, I guess we could say it's somewhat related cause two terrible tragedies, but the economic impact of 9/11, and you're like kind of like how this disaster was a lot of ways avoided through this very kind of almost trust system.
Well, it's interesting. In full disclosure, I mean, I'm not a financial historian.
I was so nervous about going into this because he says he's not an expert. He tears himself down for his knowledge set. So, to the best of your knowledge, this is how this kind of went.
Yeah, down. We were kind of studying this in a class, and I was kind of interested and was looking out on the side for it as well. But it was one of my courses with Jaron Scard, but. The one of the most interesting things, what it was, is we've been talking about like global financial governance, and I think learning that system from a French institution is really interesting because the way that like the European Union, for example, interacts with things like the IMF is really interesting because, for example,
it's a very different relationship.
It's a very different relationship. So, you know, or even central banks, because the European Union's institutions have sort of been building into themselves. So I think one of the most interesting things to talk about this semester was like, if a U.S. state went bankrupt, let's say, or, you know, as so far as they're not exactly allowed to, but, you know, they can't declare bankruptcy. But if you're really back up against the wall, the United States will sort of figure out ways to financially stabilize you, whereas the IMF will not come in and bail you out. I think one of the talks about the European Union right now, for example, is like, isn't it peculiar that we're all part of this big union and we have a central bank, but when we're back up against the wall, the IMF comes in?
Right.
That's a very different relationship in terms of international institutions. So it was kind of fun to learn about it from that standpoint because it's not, you know, it was just very fascinating. But
and could you give a quick overview of like, so what is the IMF's position in international monetary policy and
so
just
this
economics?
Is part of the brilliance of what the United States did after World War II. And I think this is actually
is this part of Marshall Plan?
No, it's separate. It's okay. When the United States and, you know, Britain and sort of the actors were sitting there and going, well, we got to hobble this system back together, but we can't really, you know, there are certain solutions for how you can build global governance. You can either build an empire and just kind of make it one system. You can have it be somewhat anarchic, you know, where just states are kind of interacting with each other. Or you can kind of have some form of liberalized order where you're trying to, you know, do it based on some voluntary adhesion to a system. So what the United States came up with was like the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. And there are other people, there's a lot of discourse going between, you know, Britain and America and other places in the world. You know, it's not just one ship deciding, you know, the direction. But they come up with like the International Monetary Fund. You come up with things like the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade or whatever, the GATT. And then you have a couple other institutions and people voluntarily adhere to them. And I think that's been sort of the perseverance of these systems.
For some benefits. It's not purely out of a philanthropic mindset.
No, because there are benefits.
There are
benefits to being part of it. You know,
but it's an elected thing. You're not required. Yeah. You're not put under the yoke of the monetary fund.
Yeah, and I think that's probably been part of the reason why this system, you know, does well, you know, why it perseveres even in the face of crisis, and that even during the worst of crises, you know, people still want to join it. You know, our country still want to join it. You know, you want to be part of the club, not out of it. But one of the most interesting things that we were talking about in this course, and I think it makes so much sense in retrospect, but the idea of like mutual recognition, and it's a sort of, it's not this moment that you arrive at magically, but it's a sort of, when you have bankers and you have a central bank in your
country.
It's
like a spectrum sort of kind of cross into.
Yeah, and you know, I don't think you always know when you've walked into it, but a lot of the central banks in the world, you know, you have sort of technocratic elites, which, you know, I understand is problematic unto itself in many ways because you have questions about democratic accountability. But I think the episode that you have is when you have central banks, technocrats, who a lot of them attend the same PhD programs and whatever, but they adhere to some sense of, of trust between each other. And when they're running these big organizations, whether it's the European Central Bank or the Fed or wherever, it creates this sort of, they're able to really coordinate policy in ways that become very interesting. And I think we sometimes assume that the sort of backroom dealing becomes nefarious, whether it's the Big Short or whether, you know, it's the 2008 financial crisis, which it can be. But there's also at times these very interesting moments of where they come up with a financial innovation that actually does preserve the system. And what this is, the episode that we learned about, I just thought it was absolutely fascinating, is when we think about things like 9/11, it was the immediacy of the crisis and as, you know, horrifying, you know, as the loss of life and everything. There was also, though, you know, a financial dimension of it in the sense that these were the World Trade Centers and they had hedge funds in them and they have finance, you know, investment banks and all sorts of billions upon billions upon billions, hundreds of billions, I'm sure.
Capital flowing through it,
you know, and deciding this in its proximity to New York, you know, Stock Exchange. It was fascinating just talking about it. It's one thing you don't always think about is what happens when these two ginormous buildings with all of this financial innovation is gone. And so what the United States came up with is it acted like a lender of last resort, which is an interesting function for us to play because a lot of countries have sort of not wanted to be that role where you're responsible for bailing out the global financial system, essentially, because it's a lot for any one bank or a country.
And if it doesn't work.
And then it still implodes and you just spend hundreds of billions of dollars. Right. But I think the United States, realizing what just happened, behind the doors, you know, while we're dealing with sort of the immediacy of the effects of it and we're talking about it almost in a political realm, there are all of these central banks that coordinated these massive credit swaps between each other. And it was one of the first times this ever happened where the United States kind of bought euros. So they coordinated with the European central banks and the ECB, the European Central Bank, and, you know, or the Bank of England or whatever. And they buy up pound sterling, they buy up euros, and then they buy up the yen in Japan. And then in turn, they invest in the US dollar. The US takes the foreign currencies, lends it out to the banks that are affected by this or, you know, are going to have some immediacy because, you know, there's a cash, you know, there's just a currency problem flow because, you know, of the immediacy of the crisis.
Well, no money's flowing.
Yeah, no money's flowing. And so they essentially offer short-term assets to all of these banks to keep them afloat, allow for the coordination in Europe, and they keep the system in place that way. And it's pretty incredible,
yeah,
the amount of coordination that took. And I think that's sort of when we talk about global economic, you know, global governance, and that is, I think, one of the more interesting sides of it, is that if you had one of these disasters and they happen in isolation as they do, you know, as that happened, you know, where you have just one immediate disaster in New York City, which is, you know, that you can coordinate all the economic policies across borders.
And to make sure I understand the train, it's U.S. government takes dollars, buys other currencies in other countries. Mm-hmm. Those countries take that currency investment, turn around and invest in the U.S. dollar. They take that surge in money of investment and give it to the banks to keep the banks and investment funds and all the groups that need it that were affected to bolster them in the transition period to where they get their stuff back together.
Yeah, it is my understanding. I mean, as I said, this is where...
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. But that's like kind of like... Seems to be what it looks like.
Yeah, it seems in what I've read and what I've looked at. And again, you'll have to get a financial historian in here.
There's a bunch of musical chairs with the money, but ultimately to...
Because
one group is not a part of it and you're kind of like...
No, you're kind of you're reestablishing that cash flow. The
benefits of fiat currency.
Yeah. Well, it was such an interesting though just to sit, you know, sit there and kind of realize what that level of coordination looks like how unbelievably complicated it is. But I think that it's a nice counterpoint when we talk about all the
evils
and nefariousness, and we all are very skeptical today of these systems, but we don't realize that how much benefit at times they do draw.
Yeah.
We need to be, I think, healthy dose of skepticism is there. But I think that sometimes we prescribe solutions and we say, well, if they just, you know, relinked our currency to the gold standard, would be catastrophic. But, you know, we prescribe these, you know, 2-cent solutions to these problems that are, you know.
they're not that simple.
Yeah, that are not that simple.
Can't have monocausal explanations for all our problems.
And that was one of the wonderful... And I think that learning about this from the standpoint of a French institution, and one that, to be honest, is probably a little bit further right of center than most in France. But it was such an interesting thing because their relationship to these institutions is so different. But even the perspective in most of my courses was, you know, promoting them and saying that, you know, we do need these systems, and this is the importance of governance and policy making, and this is why you're studying this, that it needs to be out of some sense of, you know, public service or whatever. But it was really, I thought it was such an interesting nuance to all of the things I was learning.
Yeah.
Cheers.
I just remember talking to that the other day, and I've never even had a clue. I never thought about the economic impact of the
World Trade Center. I might need one or two cocktails. I might explain it better, but yeah.
But I think it's fascinating. And like, even if your details aren't perfect, it's like you get the idea, though, is that through this complicated system of banking, which, you know, a lot of us are rightfully so kind of weary of, and you're always kind of like, well, what's going on under the hood? There is somewhat, it's like, well, for better or for worse, there are some benefits. And like, there are moments where there's some really innovative crisis control.
Yeah, and like, it's also, I think one of the things we never think about in the, you know, today is, you know, we understand primary actors such as nations, and they, you know, they are the primary actors still. You know, we haven't moved towards whatever. But I think that what is interesting is we never think about and sit back and go, well, what is the IMF? Why does the WTO exist? And what is their functioning? This is the system that we have designed.
Right.
And this is one that we are keeping propped up and that we are promoting actively. But we have such little knowledge about how these institutions interact with each other. You know, we all, I think, have some basic knowledge of how Congress works and how, you know, the executive branch interacts with them. But we have no idea what that looks like on an international level. And these are the people making decisions with trillions of dollars, quite literally. And I think that we should probably be moving towards having some knowledge of that as well. And it might not be the system forever. Who knows? You know, these morph. You know, the IMF has gone through many versions of itself to arrive at this sort of proactive role that it has today. But
and we talk about France and US's systems and ideals, and they're only 200 something years old. I mean, it's like at the end of the day, it's like a lot of this stuff is new, different, and startling. And it's good to have some skepticism, because if you accept it as law, you forget about the thousands of years of history where none of this stuff was ever applied. Yeah.
Or what actors are going to be entering into it. Right. You know, I mean, I think people always talk about Russia, you know, they're kind of funny. But I think China is a much more interesting...
India
will be interesting. But I think China, how China is going to interact with some of these, you know, international organizations can be very different, or even create parallel ones. Because the difference is you can't replicate the British Empire, but you can build your own IMF.
Right.
And that's a different... Yeah, and that doesn't mean that the IMF is going to lose its function or do whatever. But you know, this is what they're trying to do over there with a different institution. But like the Shanghai Development Bank, you know, functions in very similar ways. You know, and that's the difference. I think that's going to be something that's really interesting moving forward. And I think we need to have an understanding of how these.
Or at some point, will China do an about face and like suddenly start integrating into the globalized economy more directly in that way? Like,
and they're doing to be honest, they're doing it simultaneously. You know, they're kind of like creating.
They're big enough group that they can.
They're creating parallel institutions while they're joining institutions that they find beneficial.
I think you find a lot about, you understand a lot about China's social, cultural, and political policy by the fact that they basically made their own Twitter. Like, on the most basic, when you think about that on the most basic level, like the fact that not only was a business able to sit there and go, well, we have 1.3 billion people, we can straight up operate independently just within our own little walled garden. But the you know, it's, I think a lot of China's whole thing is that you're right, like they can hedge their bets and try both, because at the end of the day, they have raw numbers. Yeah. Like there is power in that. It's why India is fascinating. They also just, it's so many people. Like, talk about wealth and income inequality, talk about economic disparity. At the end of the day, like, it's a lot of people.
And also how different places interact with these institutions. Because I thought this was fascinating. Like, we were reading some stuff on like Brazil's interaction with the IMF. Brazil has, I mean, it's gone through a lot of economic reiterate. You know, it's gone through high of the highs, lows of lows. Right now it's the lowest of lows, you know, and they've gone through several bailout programs. But they have these a lot of individuals who have worked for these institutions, whether it's the IMF or the WTO, no matter. They've just been very proactive in it, so that when they actually have come to these negotiations where they have to negotiate with the IMF, they're just really good at it. And it's funny because, you know, the case of Argentina could not be more different. you know, right. There's this funny line in economics. I'm not sure it's prescribed to. It's like there are four economies in the world. It's it's like the United States, Europe, and then Japan and Argentina. You know, and back then it was because Japan, you know, was doing well. Today, not so much. But Argentina is just, it's sort of always turning the system on its head and then like coming into it and getting out of it and then figuring out ways to bend the rules. And it's a really Argentina's interactions are very interesting. And but it just kind of goes to say, and I think that that's why the importance of understanding these institutions and figuring out this is what we've created, this is what we've put our time, our energy, and investment in. What do these institutions mean, and how do they interact with us?
Right. Yeah. Scott, once again, always a pleasure.
Cheers.
Little, slightly less focused than our previous one, but I think we hit two really interesting topics. You know, yeah. Kind of did a little bit. I thought, you know, it's you always provide a lot of really unique perspectives, and you're just a smart dude. So it's always fun to do this. I look forward to our next one.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed it.
All right, man. Cheers.
Cheers.